somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation.
Episode 39, The Totalitarian Temptation, Part 2, Der Untergang.
Meinungsfreiheit in unserem Land ist gegeben. Und die beginnen da, wo gehetzt wird, da, wo Hass verbreitet wird. Die beginnen da, wo die Würde anderer Menschen verletzt wird. Und dagegen werden und müssen wir uns stellen in diesem Hause. Und das werden wir auch hinbekommen, meine Damen und Herren. Denn sonst ist diese Gesellschaft nicht mehr das, was sie war.
What you just heard was German Chancellor Angela Merkel giving an unusually passionate speech on free expression to the German Bundestag in November 2019. Merkel says that
we have freedom of expression in this country, but freedom of expression has its limits. Those limits begin where hatred is spread, where the dignity of other people is violated.
And she went on to insist that the Bundestag will and must oppose extreme speech, otherwise our society will no longer be the free society that it was. Merkel grew up under a stifling communist dictatorship and serves as chancellor of a country where vicious propaganda helped pave the way for genocide. So few have strong credentials when it comes to balancing the pros and cons of free speech. And Merkel's words of warning are impossible to separate from Germany's Nazi past and the existential dread that many Germans hold of once again witnessing a collapse of democracy and the emergence of totalitarianism, such as the Third Reich, which replaced Germany's fragile post-1918 Weimar Republic. There can be no doubt that Merkel and the German commitment to militant democracy is motivated by a sincere belief that democracies must be intolerant towards the intolerant in order to safeguard tolerance as such. To paraphrase the political philosopher Karl Popper's famous Paradox of Tolerance in his book The Open Society and Its Enemies, written in 1945, while in exile from Nazi rule. But there are also those who argue that criminalizing speech is a cure worse than the disease in democracies. To use a deliberately provocative term, laws that limit free speech might serve as enabling acts for authoritarian regimes to crush dissent once in power. George Orwell, who fought fascism with weapons during the Spanish Civil War and communism with his pen, reached the opposite conclusion to Merkel. In the unpublished foreword to his famous novel Animal Farm, Orwell warned against the widespread tendency to argue that one can only defend democracy by totalitarian methods, and in particular, to treat as enemies those who spread mistaken doctrines. Orwell cautioned,
if you encourage totalitarian methods, the time may come when they will be used against you instead of for you. Make a habit of imprisoning fascists without trial, and perhaps the process won't stop at fascists.
And even Karl Popper saw restrictions on speech as a last resort in democracies and rejected the idea that we should always suppress the utterance of intolerant philosophies. As long as we can counter them by rational argument and keep them in check by public opinion, suppression would certainly be unwise. These conflicting approaches to extreme speech are still with us today and shape most debates about the limits of hate speech. The abstract and theoretical arguments for and against tolerating extreme speech are well rehearsed. History, on the other hand, provides key insights that may help democracies draw such boundaries based on experience and determine whether to side with Merkel or Orwell. That, at any rate, is what I hope to contribute to with the following episode on free speech and repression in the Weimar Republic and the Third Reich.
Thank you.
few other periods in modern European history have become as iconic as Germany's short-lived Weimar Republic from 1918 to 1933. With its explosion of ideas and isms within culture, science, politics, and even sex, and the great culture wars that this gave rise to.
A history of the Weimar Republic is way outside the scope of this podcast. But the odds were stacked against Weimar Germany's liberal ideas from the outset. Built as it was on the ruins of Imperial Germany's catastrophic defeat in World War I and weighed down by the punitive terms of the Versailles Treaty. Add to this the radicalization of the Russian Revolution to the east, economic hardship, mass unemployment, and widespread political violence among groups hostile to democracy on the left, and especially the extreme right. Many historians divide the Weimar Republic into three phases. The first phase, from 1918 to 1923, was marred by political violence bordering on civil war. At least five unsuccessful coup attempts were launched by communists and militant right-wing groups. And from 1919 to 1923, right-wing paramilitary groups terrorized the country with more than 350 political assassinations. Victims included prominent politicians, as well as the famous socialist Rosa Luxemburg, who, unlike Lenin, believed that freedom is always and exclusively freedom for the one who thinks differently. Then followed a so-called golden age of relative stability from 1924 to 1929, until the shockwaves from the Great Depression pulled the rug from under the German recovery and signaled the end phase from 1930 until the collapse in 1933, a period where political violence flared up again and presidential rule through emergency powers finally gave way to Hitler's dictatorship. But despite the violence, free speech was actually a fundamental value of the Weimar Republic. On 9 November 1918, Kaiser Wilhelm abdicated, and 3 days later, the new Interim Council of People's Representatives issued a decree guaranteeing freedom of expression and universal suffrage. A further decree of 23 November clarified that the Reich government has repealed every sort of censorship. This not only ended the strict wartime censorship, but also marked a contrast to imperial times where, as we have seen, socialist publications and journalists were harshly suppressed. In 1919, freedom of speech was formalized in Article 118 of the Weimar Constitution.
Every German is entitled, within the bounds set by general law, to express his opinion freely in word, writing, print, image, or otherwise. There is no censorship.
But. Yes, there was a but. In fact, there were several buts to this principle. Article 118 did not define the permissible exceptions and explicitly permitted censorship of film as well as trashy and obscene literature to protect the youth. But even more fatally for free speech was Article 48. It allowed the Reich president to suspend civil liberties, including free speech, if public safety was threatened. This instrument would ultimately provide the killer blow to the very democracy it was supposed to protect. But there's no denying that the Weimar Constitution provided the framework for a vibrant and diverse public sphere. Historian Eric D. Weitz even claims that in the 1920s, no other European democracy, nor the US, had freer speech than Germany. As we shall see, that is probably a debatable assertion, and certainly no longer true by 1930. But still, there were some 4,700 daily newspapers by the early 1930s, with a total daily circulation of about 20 million copies. Weimar also proved extremely fertile ground for culture, literature, art, and science. You might get a sense of Berlin's bohemian atmosphere in the wonderful TV series Babylon Berlin.
Among the long list of famous authors and intellectuals, we find Thomas Mann, Bertolt Brecht, Hermann Hesse, and Theodor Adorno, as well as the filmmaker Fritz Lang and the groundbreaking Bauhaus art movement.
The Weimar era created 9 Nobel Prize winners, 5 of which were Jewish, including Albert Einstein, who profited from the end of anti-Jewish discrimination in academia in 1918. Despite the constitution, vibrant media, daring art, and intellectual feats, far from all Germans were happy with the fruits of this new and liberal public sphere.
On 24th February 1920, 2,000 people rallied in Munich and listened to the German Workers' Party's manifesto being read out aloud by a leading party member. His name was Adolf Hitler. Among his demands was legal warfare on deliberate political mendacity and its dissemination in the press. Only Germans should be allowed to edit, write, finance, and influence German language publications. But that was not all.
The publishing of papers which are not conducive to the national welfare must be forbidden. We demand the legal prosecution of all those tendencies in art and literature which corrupt our national life.
Nobody in 1920 would have guessed that these outlandish demands of a political outsider were to become the law of the land less than 15 years later. But in hindsight, nobody could say that they hadn't been warned. And there would be many more warnings, as Hitler used his devastating talent for public speaking to whip the crowds of Bavarian beer halls into a frenzy of hatred and become leader of the Nationalist Socialist German Workers' Party, the NSDAP. As detailed in Ian Kershaw's phenomenal biography, Hitler helped forge a renewed sense of national pride and destiny for the humiliated Germans in a cauldron of hatred where the enemies were the November traitors that had stabbed the German army in the back, democracy, Marxism, and above all, the puppeteers behind this conspiracy to subjugate the German people, the Jews. Genocide may not have been an explicit idea at this point, but Hitler ominously spoke of the need to combat racial tuberculosis by removing Jews from Germany. A very direct warning came in 1923 with the ill-fated beer hall putsch. The authorities of Bavaria had actually banned several Nazi rallies where armed paramilitaries marched around looking for violent clashes with leftists. But the authorities were too weak to systematically enforce the bans. And on 8 and 9 November, Hitler, inspired by Mussolini's march on Rome, tried to overthrow the government in Bavaria and launch a national revolution. 4 police officers lay dead, a social democratic newspaper destroyed, and several social democratic city councillors were taken hostage before the disorganized coup fizzled out. Hitler was convicted for high treason, but given a ridiculously lenient sentence of 5 years after a trial which he was allowed to use as a propaganda platform. Now, this is a good time to halt the narrative, because no matter how absolute, pure, and principled you like your free speech, this is the point in time where Hitler should have been consigned to the dustbin of history. Attempting an armed overthrow of the government, resulting in deaths of police officers, should have been met with a one-strike policy and resulted in a stiff prison sentence. And even if released after, say, 20 years, Hitler should not have been allowed to run a whole political office again. Nor should the ban against the NSDAP have been lifted so soon. But Weimar judges were generally very lenient towards right-wing extremists, whereas they would lay down the law with severity when it came to communists. You might also argue that the authorities should have been much more firm in banning the assembly of armed paramilitaries. This would not have prevented specific Nazi or ethno-racial, Völkisch in German, viewpoints or political ideals. But it would have sent a firm message that paramilitary groupings threatening the democratic order and monopoly on violence would not be tolerated. Hitler only served 8 months in prison. While locked away, he wrote his autobiographic book, Mein Kampf, which included further warning signs as to what the future of free speech would look like under National Socialism. And Hitler had not grown milder since his speech in 1920. To Hitler, the vast majority of the people were credulous simpletons who believed everything they read in the press. And since these people also decided democratic elections, the press was of paramount importance. With ruthless determination, the state must keep control of this instrument of popular education and place it at the service of the state and the nation, he wrote. But this had been completely neglected so far. Instead, Hitler accused the liberal press of being concerned only with digging the grave for the German people and Reich whereas the lying Marxist press was spreading falsehoods to enslave the nation for the benefit of international finance and its masters, the Jews. And the state had meekly allowed the media to hide behind the principle of freedom of the press and liberty of public opinion, which permitted poison to enter the national bloodstream and infect public life with complete impunity. The solution was to bring the press under state control and free it from the enemies of the people, a term dear to both Lenin and Hitler. What might newspapers under state control look like? Hitler, once again, was brutally honest. He had very low opinions of the intellectual capacities of the majority of the people, whose will he supposedly embodied once the Hitler myth was cemented. Accordingly, the people should be fed propaganda which should be exclusively aimed at the masses.
All effective propaganda must be confined to a few bare essentials, and those must be expressed as far as possible in stereotype formulas. These slogans should be persistently repeated until the very last individual has come to grasp the idea that has been put forward.
Hitler had clearly sketched a future of strict ideological censorship and wall-to-wall propaganda. When Mein Kampf was published in 1925, that future looked as unrealistic as it was disturbing. But that would change, and Hitler's dystopian public sphere would become all too real. And again, there are eerie similarities between the way Hitler, Lenin, and Mussolini viewed free speech as a corrosive principle abused by enemies of the people to subvert and lead astray the masses from the truth, as embodied by the leader and ruling party, whose unique ability to represent the genuine interest of the people must be ruthlessly protected from dissent and lies. Few were as hostile to the idea of press freedom as Hitler. But even Weimar Germany's Democrats have difficulties with the practice of free speech. As we've seen, the Constitution allowed censorship of cinema and pulp fiction. And in 1920, a law introduced film censorship to counter so-called Aufklärungsfilme, or Enlightenment films. These were actually educational, but since they dealt with issues such as sex, drugs, and prostitution, they were accused of being thinly veiled erotic films, undermining morals for profit in a flood of filth constituting a national danger. As one politician claimed, even one night of watching Enlightenment films could emotionally destroy a young person for their entire life. In 1926, a moral panic about the brutalizing and immoral danger of trash literature resulted in a law to protect the youth against trash and filth in pulp fiction. Some of the concerns sound like modern complaints about smartphones and social media.
Young people of both sexes sit on the tram or train so transfixed by these notorious pamphlets that they forget all that they hear and see.
The trash that so concerned German politicians included American serial novels such as Buffalo Bill and Texas Jack. Dangerous stuff indeed. But the censorship of trash and filth also met resistance. The famous author Thomas Mann warned,
"The need to protect our youth from filth and trash is nothing more than a pretext. The law's drafters want to use the law's penetrating power against freedom, against intellect itself."
These laws did not seriously impact the overall climate of free speech in Weimar Germany. But they did highlight and formalize deep apprehensions about free speech. And when the Nazis assumed power, they latched onto the idea that literary trash and filth could pollute and corrupt the moral and psychological welfare of the nation. Though, of course, Nazi censorship was much more all-encompassing and protected the entire German people, not just the youth. But Weimar Democrats also struggled with how to balance free speech when confronted by sensationalist reporting and fanatical agitation in a country marred by political terror and coordinated street violence. In fact, historian Orrin James Hale has argued that in the struggle for the preservation of the Republic, the principle of freedom of the press was a major casualty. And historian Bernhard Fulda claims that no other Western liberal democracy in this period, witnessed the joining of democratic forces from socialists to liberals, intended to pass a law curtailing press freedom. The first step in a gradual escalation of repression was the 1922 Law for the Defense of the Republic, which permitted the authorities to suppress newspapers expressing contempt for the existing state structure, the national flag, members of the government, or advocacy of violence. Here it's important to note that in general, the German press was a Weltanschauungspresse, meaning that it was based on opinion and ideology more than a commitment to objectivity and neutrality. So a liberal in Berlin, a communist in Hamburg, and a nationalist conservative in Bavaria would not recognize that they lived in the same country if they read each other's newspapers where current events were interpreted through a partisan ideological lens. New research has challenged the claim that social media create polarizing digital echo chambers, but the ideological echo chamber effect of print media was real in Weimar Germany. This helped provoke political action since, again, not unlike today, German politicians tended to think that people believed everything they read and therefore overestimated the effects and reach of the most partisan newspapers. And in the 1930s, the cross-fertilization between violent clashes and sensationalist press reports invoking the language of civil war meant that even social democrats, whose newspapers had been systematically suppressed in Imperial Germany, started having doubts about press freedom. Leading social democrats lamented that press freedom had degenerated into freedom for lying and slander and the most poisonous weapon against democracy. And so, in the final years of the Republic, a steady stream of increasingly draconian laws and emergency decrees continuously eroded press freedom. The Law for the Defense of the Republic was expanded in 1930. Then, the immunities of MPs acting as editors were lifted. And in 1931, a presidential emergency decree under Article 48 of the Constitution expanded the government's power to ban newspapers for up to 2 months. Initially, even the liberal press was on board with this development. In order to protect itself effectively against lies and slander, the state has to be allowed to compromise basic rights, like the freedom of the press, wrote one mainstream newspaper. But then followed a law against the assertion of false facts, which authorized the government to force newspapers to print corrections, announcements, and replies, and ban papers that threatened public peace and order. And then, yet another emergency decree of June 1932 further tightened government control with newspapers and expanded the permissible grounds for suppression. And these provisions were not empty threats. During Heinrich Brüning's chancellorship from March 1930 to May 1932, 284 newspapers were suppressed in Prussia alone, 99 of which were Nazi, 77 communist, and 43 belonged on the extreme right. And now suddenly, the media realized that these measures intended to curb fanaticism and anti-democratic forces had become an existential threat to press freedom and independent media as such. The liberal Berliner Tagesblatt compared the estimated 100 monthly systematic newspaper bans in Germany to the press climate in fascist Italy and Soviet Russia. A few months later, the Tagesblatt declared the end of press freedom. But it was too late to protest. In June 1932, Franz von Papen became chancellor, and until his resignation in November 1932, 95 newspapers were suspended. The plurality were communist, with Nazis in second place. In fact, in 1932, the communist newspaper Rote Fahne was banned on more than a third of its publication days. But social democratic and left liberal newspapers critical of Nazism were also suppressed. And by now, even cartoons were sufficient to be banned. This included caricatures skewering von Papen's decision to lift the ban against the Nazi paramilitary organization, the SA, which had led to an explosion of street violence, as well as caricatures mocking von Papen's rule by emergency decrees. Now here, I can't help but marvel at the contrast between Weimar Germany's increasingly systematic banning of newspapers that wrote about political violence
and the comparatively lenient attitude towards the various groups and associations that committed violence. This has famously led some to describe Weimar as a democracy without democrats or a republic without republicans, since the state was too feeble to challenge its enemies and since many of its institutions, not least the courts, contributed to eroding republican ideals. And as we shall see, the constant erosion of constitutional principles helped pave the way for the abolition of free speech as such when Hitler assumed power. But given that the Nazis abolished free speech, it's particularly relevant to zoom in on how Weimar authorities handled the virulent hatred, anti-Semitism, and fanatical anti-democratic agitation of the NSDAP. Not least because banning Nazi agitation remains an important part of the anti-extremist arsenal of many democracies to this day. As early as 1920 and 1921, the Nazi party newspaper, the Völkische Beobachter, was temporarily banned for anti-Semitic excesses. And under the Law for the Defense of the Republic, the NSDAP was banned in Prussia from 1922 to 1925, and then again in 1926 after political violence. After the beer hall putsch, both the NSDAP and the Völkische Beobachter were banned across Germany until 1925. The continued popularity and fierce propaganda of Adolf Hitler saw most German states ban him from public speaking between 1925 to 1927, though the ban persisted until 1928 in Prussia. No doubt, the ban was an impediment to the NSDAP, which relied on Hitler's mesmerizing speeches for popular support. But the ban also provided its own opportunities for fruitful propaganda. Leading Nazis like Goebbels organized and spoke at protests against this gross and illegal injustice. Posters were produced depicting a muscled Hitler as a martyr unfairly singled out for repression by the system, with captions like, "Crooks can speak anywhere in Germany, but Hitler's banned," and "Of 2 billion people in the world, he alone is banned from speaking in Germany." This opportunistic, selective, and deeply hypocritical appeal to free speech when it serves one's own agenda, still a familiar tactic among right-wing populists, was also a standard tactic when other Nazi publications were targeted by the authorities. The two most notorious ones were Joseph Goebbels' Der Angriff and Julius Streicher's virulently anti-Semitic Der Stürmer. Der Angriff was actually founded by Goebbels as a direct response to the NSDAP ban in Berlin, which hurt the party's ability to attract attention and followers. Der Angriff specialized in anti-Semitic trolling. "Germany awake, Jewry be damned" was a frequent slogan. Its favorite target was Berlin's Jewish vice president of the police force, Bernhard Weiss, who was demonized with anti-Semitic cartoons and tropes. As a result, Weiss, perhaps unwisely, consistently pursued Der Angriff in court, where he often won libel suits. But the many court cases played into Goebbels' hands, as he could portray the NSDAP and Der Angriff as victims of the very kind of Jewish conspiracy to enslave the German people, which National Socialism was trying to warn the German people against. And shamelessly, Goebbels also appealed to free speech and legal protections, although he loathed these principles. The laws and presidential decrees of 1930 and 1932 provided further legal ammunition against Der Angriff. Between November 1930 and August 1932, the newspaper was administratively banned 13 times for a combined total of 19 weeks, and Goebbels proudly proclaimed Der Angriff to be Germany's most frequently banned daily. According to historian Russell Lemons, the legal pursuit of Der Angriff was a double-edged sword. On the one hand, press bans seriously hurt the finances of Der Angriff, which came close to folding. But on the other hand, it gave the paper much-needed attention and crucial propaganda victories when acting as the small persecuted victim of draconian persecution, which struck a chord with the many Germans who had lost faith in the authorities of Weimar Germany. Julius Streicher's Der Stürmer took anti-Semitism to sickening levels of depravity. And after the war, Streicher, known as Jew-baiter No. 1,
was sentenced to death and executed for crimes against humanity due to his incitement to murder and extermination. But in Weimar times, Das Stürmer's antisemitism was less explicitly violent, however stomach-churning. Several Jewish groups and individuals tried to curb Das Stürmer through the courts, using libel suits as well as criminal law provisions that prohibited incitement to enmity and violence amongst classes of citizens, as well as offenses against religion. And twice Steiker was convicted for violating the latter due to blood libels that accused Judaism, and therefore Jews, of ritual murders. In 1929, Steiker was sentenced to 2 months in prison, but left court cheered by 400 supporters. Much like Der Angriff, Das Stürmer used its defeats in court to win in the realm of propaganda. Apparently it worked, because shortly after Steiker's verdict, the NSDAP tripled its votes in local elections in Thuringia and then more than doubled its votes in Steiker's hometown of Nuremberg in the federal elections of 1930. No doubt, many Germans were horrified by the crude antisemitism and welcomed legal action. But to the growing number of Germans who wished to see the end of Weimar democracy, it seems that convictions for speech crimes was a badge of honor. And this was no accident, but a deliberate tactic which once again showed that Hitler was ahead of the curve when it came to propaganda and understanding mass psychology. In Mein Kampf, he had written that ideas and philosophical systems could not be broken by force unless such force was in the service of a new compelling idea. Without a strong moral justification for persecution, only total extermination of the ideas and its champions could eradicate ideas. However, what we may call persecution without moral purpose will
raise opposition among the best elements of the population, so much so that these are driven more and more to champion the ideas that are unjustly persecuted. With many individuals, this arises from the sheer spirit of opposition to every attempt at suppressing spiritual things by brute force.
And as we shall see, the Weimar Republic's persecution of Nazi propaganda would play a key role in Hitler's justification of his own persecution of Weimar Republicans.
More effective against Nazi propaganda was the Weimar radio policy, under which the state tightly controlled content in order to defend democracy. Political broadcasts were government-friendly and both Nazis and communists were banned from the airwaves. A number of social scientists have sought to measure how radio affected support for the Nazis during Weimar Germany and the Third Reich, respectively. They find that the pro-government content and ban against Nazi broadcasts helped limit electoral support for the Nazis between 1928 and the start of 1933. But the flip side of this approach is that total control of German radio was served wrapped up on a platter once the Nazis were in power. In fact, in August 1933, Goebbels famously claimed that our way of taking power and using it would have been inconceivable without the radio. Radio then helped the Nazis in the tainted election of March 1933, and once limited to a propaganda vehicle, became a factor in convincing Germans to denounce Jews to the authorities, though the increase in anti-Semitic action was limited to areas of Germany where anti-Jewish sentiments were already prevalent. Contrary to popular belief, Hitler didn't float into power on a democratic majority. The best result the Nazis ever got in a free election was an impressive 37.2% of the vote in July 1932, up from a paltry 2.6% in 1928. But when the Germans went back to the polls in November 1932, the Nazis lost 2 million votes and plunged to 33.1%. And Hitler also lost when he ran against Hindenburg in the presidential election of 1932. But much like Mussolini and the Italian fascists, the Nazis made an unholy alliance with traditional parties. Conservatives who longed for a more authoritarian, nationalistic and militaristic state thought Hitler could be a pawn in their strategy to strangle democracy. Still, President Hindenburg long resisted putting Hitler directly in charge. But after a long Game of Thrones, where democracy lost out, he finally caved in. Hitler was made Reich Chancellor on January 30th, 1933. And it soon became clear that Hitler had no intention of being played or even challenged by anyone. Immediately after the election, Hitler's government banned the communist newspaper Rote Fahne as well as the SPD newspaper Vorwärts for having encouraged its readers to defend their rights. On February 4th, an emergency decree for the defense of the German people gave the police authority to ban political meetings and demonstrations and newspapers that published incorrect news as determined by the Nazi Minister of Interior. Once again, Hitler was copying from Lenin's playbook. Goebbels couldn't contain his glee. In his diary, he wrote,
"Now we also have a lever against the press, and bans will pop like crazy. All those Jewish organs which cost us so much trouble and grief will disappear all at once from the streets of Berlin."
But at this point, Hitler's attack on the press was merely an escalation of the draconian press policy which Weimar's democratic politicians had set in motion themselves and which the mainstream press, now under assault, had initially been behind. But much like Lenin and Trotsky, Hitler had no intention of relaxing his grip on the media ever again. And on February 27th, he was given the perfect pretext to once and for all rid the remaining constitutional impediments to Nazi rule. There's no consensus on how precisely events unfolded or who was responsible, but it seems the radical Dutch communist Marinus van der Lubbe set the German Reichstag on fire. It was almost too good to be true. Practically foaming at the mouth, Hitler raged, "This is a God-given signal. If this fire, as I believe, turns out to be the handiwork of communists, then there's nothing that should stop us now from crushing out this murderous pest with an iron fist." The very next day, Hitler pushed Hindenburg to issue two emergency decrees as a defensive measure against communist acts of violence endangering the state. The decree suspended seven constitutional freedoms until further notice, including the freedoms of expression, press, assembly, and habeas corpus. It also gave the police wide surveillance powers. Formally, Hitler had merely relied on the supposed safety valve of Weimar Germany's own constitution. In practice, Germany was on the path to becoming a totalitarian police state.
And the timing was perfect, since elections were to take place on March 5th, only 6 days after the Reichstag fire. The suspension of civil liberties and campaign of terror allowed Hitler to effectively eliminate the communists from the election and marginalize the Social Democrats without formally banning these parties. Still, the Nazis only received some 44% of the votes rather than an all-out majority.
After assuming power, Hitler let 2.5 million stormtroopers of the paramilitary SA and SS loose in the German streets to do his dirty work and systematically vandalize, intimidate, loot, beat up, or kill those political enemies and social outsiders which were deemed a threat to the state. Now, this was not a general campaign of terror against the ordinary population, and targets were chiefly communists. Within days, the regime arrested 4,000 communists in hastily improvised prisons, ranging from run-down factories to bars and basements. According to the Nazis' reinterpretations of Schutzhaft, or protective custody, the police had authority to indefinitely detain these enemies of the state without trial. And on 20th March, Heinrich Himmler announced the opening of Germany's first regular concentration camp in a former gunpowder factory near Dachau to be used for people who threatened the security of the state. On March 23rd, Hitler managed to pass the so-called Enabling Act, which allowed laws passed by the government to bypass both the parliament and president.
With the votes of the Catholic Center Party and the German National People's Party, Hitler had paved the way to absolute dictatorship, although in practice he let his underlings exercise much of his authority.
Most of the deputies who would have opposed the Enabling Act were already in prison, concentration camp, or exile. But the Social Democrat Otto Wels stood firm and protested. He highlighted the need to permit criticism and equality.
In this historical hour, we German Social Democrats pledge ourselves to the principles of humanity and justice, of freedom and socialism. No Enabling Act gives you the power to eradicate ideas which are eternal and indestructible.
But Hitler not only had the votes, but also the rhetorical comeback to checkmate Wells' complaint. If Wells was so enthusiastic about equal rights, free speech, and the benefits of criticism, why hadn't he defended the Nazis?
Damals sind Ihnen diese Zitate noch nicht zu Gesicht gekommen, sondern damals hat man unsere Presse verboten und verboten und wieder verboten, unsere Versammlungen verboten und uns das Reden verboten und mir das Reden verboten, jahrelang. Und jetzt sagen Sie, Kritik ist heilsam.
You should have recognized the beneficial power of criticism when we were in the opposition. Back then, our press was verboten and verboten and again verboten. Our assemblies were banned. We were not allowed to speak, and I was not allowed to speak, and that went on for years. And now you say criticism is beneficial?
We should not imagine that Hitler was sincere, and that if only the Democratic parties had fought Nazis with words, Hitler would not have used force. But the many examples of anti-Nazi repression provided a facade of legitimacy to Hitler's systematic repression and helped deflect criticism, since he could use the potent weapon of whataboutery and accuse the Social Democrats of hypocrisy and double standards. This helped shine a more justified and less totalitarian light on the measures of Hitler's crackdown. And by the end of March, the regime had arrested 20,000 communists, and that figure rose to 100,000 by summer as Social Democrats, trade union officials, anarchists, and social outsiders like homosexuals, criminals, and alcoholics were added to the mix. Now, these early concentration camps should not be confused with the death camps that were built in occupied Poland during the war. Most prisoners of the early concentration camps were released after relatively short stints. But an estimated 600, but probably more, died from torture and mistreatment. By the way, if you want a more detailed story of Nazi concentration camps, I highly recommend the Third Reich History podcast. Social Democrats who weren't deported to concentration camps were often terrorized, humiliated, and beat into compliance. A leading Social Democrat in Cologne was forced to drink a mixture of oil and urine, while the Social Democratic Minister President of Mecklenburg was tortured to death, tied in a sack, and thrown into a river with 12 other party members. By the end of May 1933, stormtroopers had removed some 500 municipal administrators and 70 mayors from their positions by force. In June, the government banned the Communist and Social Democratic parties. When Social Democrats attempted an armed resistance in the Berlin suburb of Köpenick, the stormtroopers arrested 500 and tortured 91 to death. And after the ban of the SPD, an estimated 3,000 leading members were arrested, beaten, and in some instances killed. When Hitler had muscled the left, he turned his attention to the rest of the political spectrum. Stormtroopers attacked the political meetings of the Catholic Center Party and the Liberal Party, beating up leading members. From June to July, this intimidation led to a wave of political suicides as one party after another dissolved. Even Hitler's old allies in the reactionary nationalist People's Parties were in for a rude awakening. They had provided crucial votes for Hitler and cheered the crackdown on the left. But now, the anti-democratic measures they had helped push through came back to haunt them. Hitler felt no debt of gratitude and threatened to arrange a bloodbath lasting 3 days if the leaders didn't dissolve the party. So they did. And needless to say, Hitler was not about to repeat the mistake of tolerating hostile paramilitary groups that could challenge Nazi domination on the streets. So these two were brutalized, banned, Nazified, or simply swallowed up by the SA. The Center Party was the last party to be persuaded to dissolve. Shortly after, the Nazis passed a law of July 14th, banning all political parties except the NSDAP, as well as the formation of new parties. In less than 6 months, Hitler had transformed Germany into a one-party dictatorship unrestrained by any constitutional rights of the citizen. The Third Reich has been called a dual state because it operated on a combination of the regular judicial system and the arbitrary power of Hitler and the police. When the worst enemies of the state had been placed in protective custody, deported to concentration camps, or beaten into submission, the regime needed to formalize its control of the public sphere through legal means, not least to both accommodate and mute public criticism of the harsh measures used against communists and social democrats. Understandably, we associate the terror of Nazi Germany with the concentration camps. But according to historian Richard J. Evans, laws were equally important in consolidating Nazi rule, and the regular courts and existing state apparatus, which was now unleashed from the restraints of constitutional freedoms, could be turned into a weapon against dissent. In April 1933, Hitler cleansed the judicial system from anti-Nazi and Jewish judges and lawyers. Then judicial associations were merged into the National Socialist League of German Jurists. This Nazification was cheered on by the Academy of German Law and prominent legal theorists like Carl Schmitt, who argued that German law should be cleansed from Jewish influences. A set of laws from 1933 and 1934 introduced ever more wide-ranging and vague laws against speech crimes. In March 1933, the Malicious Practices Act extended defamation to protect the government and Nazi parties and associations. Those who were accused of gossiping or making fun of government officials could be arrested and sent to prison or concentration camps. Yes, Hitler jokes were officially prohibited. Then followed a treason law from April 1933. Anyone who, quote-unquote, planned to alter the Constitution by force or conspiracy could be executed by beheading. To write, print, or distribute a leaflet promoting an alteration like the return to democracy or advocating Hitler's retirement was considered high treason. And the slightest association with an offender could be interpreted as conspiracy. A third law from December 1934 punished so-called hateful statements about leading figures of the party or the state with prison. Turns out, Nazis like hate speech laws too. And to cap it off, the Malicious Gossip Act targeted derogatory statements about Nazi leaders or rumors about the regime. This included verbal expressions, even when made in private, and effectively made any criticism, including subjective opinion, of the Nazi party a crime, though punishments only ranged from 3 to 6 months. The judges of the Third Reich did not hesitate before passing convictions. In 1937, the German courts handed down a staggering 5,255 convictions for high treason. Some of the offenders were executed, while some got long prison sentences. From 1932 to 1937, the number of inmates in Germany increased from 69,000 to 122,000. Around 23,000 of them were labeled political prisoners. For a deep dive on Nazi speech crimes, I once again recommend the phenomenal Third Reich History podcast, which provides much more detail. Only weeks after the Nazis were in power, Hermann Göring set about using modern technology to give the government and the dominant party such far-reaching insight into the thoughts, feelings, and aspirations of the entire German people as had never been known in all history, as well as to penetrate all means of communication existing within Germany or leading from here to foreign countries. Though it seems that interagency infighting and technological issues frustrated Göring's ambitions. But where technology failed, human eyes and ears succeeded. Informers known as block wardens kept an eye on their neighbors and workplaces. They informed the party if a neighbor or a colleague criticized the regime, told a Hitler joke, or forgot to flag on Hitler's birthday. In 1935, the regime had around 200,000 informants. By the beginning of the war, that had risen to 2 million. One of the most sinister forms of surveillance took place in the mandatory youth organization Hitlerjugend, where children were pressed to inform on their own parents. Accordingly, surveillance and social control was not primarily carried out by sadistic Gestapo officers raiding the homes of ordinary citizens. the bulk of the work was carried out by ordinary citizens themselves. The third stage after the power grab was the so-called Gleichschaltung of Germany. It meant complete conformity and control of everything from trade and economy to culture and education. As Hitler had declared in March 1933.
The Reich government intends to undertake a thorough moral purging of the German popular body. The entire system of education, the theater, the cinema, literature, the press and radio, they all will be used as a means to this end and valued accordingly. They must all work to preserve the eternal values residing in the essential character of our people.
Membership of the German Volkgemeinschaft, or People's Community, was a compulsory closed-shop system in which information flowed downstream in carefully measured doses only. And on March 14th, the government established a Reich Ministry of Popular Enlightenment and Propaganda and put Joseph Goebbels in charge of everything from newspapers, magazines and books to music, movies, radio and art. The Aryan Civil Service legislation of April 7, 1933 removed Jews and anti-Nazis from state employment in institutions like schools, universities, courtrooms, post offices and public transportation. Controlling the press and the news stream was one of the most important objects of Goebbels' Gleichschaltung, which, as we have seen, had already been sketched by Hitler in Mein Kampf. The strategy was to weed out alternative news sources, micromanage the surviving press, and make sure the Germans were only exposed to one version of the truth. Newspapers openly critical to Nazism had already been dealt with by the Reichstag's fire decree. But just like Lenin did not stop at rooting out the bourgeois press, so Hitler was not satisfied with the purge of Marxist, communist, and Jewish newspapers. Obviously, the German press had to be Aryanized, so according to the editor's law, members of the Printers Guild had to be racially pure. Jewish journalists and editors, and even Germans married to Jews, were replaced with pure Germans, loyal or opportunistic enough to play by the rules. A few liberal papers like the Berliner Tageblatt were purged from Jews but allowed to publish with some editorial freedom, until eventually closed by the Nazis too. The papers that weren't closed down were subjected to suffocating laws on ownership and operation, or strategically starved out of advertising funds that forced many to fold or be bought for next to nothing by powerful Nazi publishers like Franz Eher, who owned two-thirds of the German papers in 1939.
This policy is still a favorite tactic of populist strongmen like Hungary's Viktor Orban. The papers which endured the Great Purge of 1933 survived on a combination of self-censorship and compliance to a growing number of laws and directives. The Reich Press Chamber micromanaged the press with daily directives and guidelines on everything from format to length and content. Anyone who didn't comply was punished with a pink slip or even a stint in a concentration camp. In October 1933, the restrictions were formalized in a so-called editor's law, which prohibited writings calculated to weaken the strength of the Reich abroad or at home, the resolution of the community, German defense, culture, or the economy. In other words, critical journalism was banned by law. In the end, few papers did more than copy-paste their stories from a government agency called the Deutsches Nachrichtenbüro. So effective had Nazi control of the media become that Goebbels noted in his diary that
no decent journalist with any feeling of honor in his bones can stand the way he is handled by the press department of the Reich government. Any man who still has a residue of honor will be very careful not to become a journalist.
When the Nazis came into power, there had been around 4,700 daily newspapers. In 1944, only 977 papers remained, and the Nazis directly controlled 82% of them. The number of periodicals and journals also plummeted from 10,000 in 1933 to 5,000 in 1938. For all intent and purposes, independent journalism was dead.
In Berlin, Wie in anderen Universitätsstädten Deutschlands wurden undeutsche und unsittliche Bücher von den Studenten eingesammelt und öffentlich verbrannt.
Deutsche Männer und Frauen, das Zeitalter eines überspitzten jüdischen Intellektualismus ist nun zu Ende. Und der Durchbruch der deutschen Revolution hat auf dem deutschen Weg wieder die Gasse freigemacht. Und der kommende deutsche Mensch wird nicht nur ein Mensch des Buches.
As all good authoritarian regimes, the Nazis created their own index of censorship with forbidden books and authors. And what you just heard was a TV broadcast from the infamous and iconic book burnings of such banned literature on May 10th, 1933, organized by Nazi student groups across 34 major cities and towns. At the Opernplatz in Berlin alone, some 25,000 un-German books were tossed into the flames. The speech was by Goebbels, who declared that the era of extreme Jewish intellectualism has come to an end and the German Revolution has again opened the way for the true essence of being German. He denounced the trash and filth of Jewish literature, including Jewish writers like Stefan Zweig and, of course, Heinrich Heine. The very author who in the 19th century had warned that where they burn books, they will ultimately also burn people. And as you'll recognize, the Nazi reference to trash and filth had an eerie similarity to the language used in the 1920s when democratic parties had been struck by moral panic and censored cinema and pulp fiction. Art and culture were not given a free pass from alignment with Nazi ideals and had to be cleansed from Jews, anti-Nazis and avant-gardists. The party actively promoted regime-friendly artists, directors, writers and performers as effective tools of propaganda. Film was a favorite media of Goebbels and regulated by a number of different institutions. First, a dramaturg within the Ministry of Propaganda had to approve the script. Upon approval, the dramaturg had the authority to micromanage every step of the production. The final hurdle was an office called the Filmprüfstelle, which could either ban the film according to a growing number of criteria or give it a distinction mark. The most famous examples of Nazi propaganda films include The Triumph of the Will by Leni Riefenstahl, the anti-Semitic Der ewige Jude, and the Ich klage an, which legitimized euthanasia of the disabled and ethnic minorities. Art had to be realistic, Aryan, and supportive of Nazi ideology. Everything which failed to live up to these criteria was marked as Bolshevist, Antater, or degenerate. The regime confiscated more than 20,000 artworks from the state-owned museums in the early 1930s. In 1937, it put 740 works on display in a defamatory exhibition of Entartekunst to educate the people on the art of decay. And according to the Nazis, abstract art was the direct result of genetic inferiority, mental illnesses, and moral decline. Some of the degenerate artworks were destroyed, while some of the costly artworks were deemed as marketable and sold off on behalf of the government.
The confiscated and exhibited artworks included works by international artists like Picasso, Matisse and Klee, and German modernists like Otto Dix and even Emil Nolde, who was actually a member of the NSDAP.
The ultimate purpose of the combination of censorship and comprehensive propaganda was to ensure that the thoughts and ideas of the average German conformed to the ideals of the Volksgemeinschaft, based on Nazi ideology and embodied by Hitler. The aim was to penetrate the very mind of the German people. The German Jewish linguist Viktor Klemperer, who survived the Holocaust, famously observed that the most powerful Hitlerian propaganda tool was not speeches, articles, flyers, posters, or flags. It was a gradual change of the German language.
Nazism permeated the flesh and blood of the people through single words, idioms, and sentence structures which were imposed on them in a million repetitions and taken on board mechanically and unconsciously. Words can be like tiny doses of arsenic. They are swallowed unnoticed, appear to have no effect, and then, after a little time, the toxic reaction sets in after all.
Without independent media, opposition parties, civil society, trade unions, or tolerance of dissent,
There was no antidote to the linguistic arsenic of constant Nazi propaganda. In fact, Richard J. Evans argues that the incessant indoctrination of Nazi propaganda helps explain the shocking brutality of the German war machine once set in motion in 1939. And by extension, the even more shocking brutality of the master race in the ever-expanding Lebensraum, where Hitler's fevered fantasies of ridding the world of the racial tuberculosis of Jewry was put into practice in death camps and large-scale massacres. But interestingly, younger Germans, whose worldview was shaped by the combination of censorship, repression, and propaganda, and those already predisposed towards Nazi ideology, were more susceptible to the indoctrination than those who had encountered and formed different political or religious ideas and values during Weimar Germany. Leftist underground groups remained active, and Catholics resisted the attempts to replace crucifixes with images of Hitler in schools. One of the most iconic and outspoken critics of Nazism was the Protestant theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He resisted Nazification of the church and became the leading spokesman of the Confessing Church, which refused to put the word of Hitler before the word of God. In his essay, The Church and the Jewish Question, Bonhoeffer insisted that the church had an obligation to speak out against Nazism, help the victims of suppression, whether Christian or Jewish, and to put a spoke in the wheel of the machinery of injustice. To do so, he worked to ensure ecumenical condemnation of Nazism outside Germany, and secretly taught resistance theology at clandestine seminaries and helped Jews escape. But Gestapo was on to Bonhoeffer and banned him from Berlin in January 1938, and in the following years he was banned from speaking in public and then from printing and publishing his views altogether. After being involved in an attempt to assassinate Hitler, Bonhoeffer was arrested in April 1943 and sent to a concentration camp until hanged in April 1945, weeks before the end of the war. Needless to say, the outbreak of war only made censorship and repression worse, both in Germany and Europe as such. But when the world community came together in the United Nations with the ambition of creating a new world order based on international law and human rights, free speech and its limits once again became a burning issue. And as we shall see in the next episode, the states that pushed for prohibiting extreme speech in international human rights law were not Western democracies, but their new ideological rivals on the other side of the Iron Curtain that separated the participants in the Cold War.